Today is February the 16th, 2022. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and the other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. That's prn.live, streaming on the internet. Podcasts of the program is also available on prn.live on the internet. ARM is an acronym for Advanced Risk Machine, but its original name was Acorn Risk Machine, developed by ARM Holdings. And this architecture was licensed to the third-party developer to package this in their products. The 6502-based BBC Micro Series was the first ARM product to be released. The NVIDIA dream of owning one of the world's most disruptive chip designer is over. Japanese conglomerate SoftBank, holders of UK-based chip design powerhouse ARM, whose chips power most of modern-day smart devices, has announced that the company is going to the initial public offering route, that's the IPO. NVIDIA has in the meantime confirmed the same ending, with both companies citing significant regulatory challenges as cause. It's a modern-day death by a thousand cuts. ARM has a bright future and will continue to support them as a proud licensee for decades to come, said NVIDIA CEO. ARM is at the center of the important dynamics in computing. Though we won't be one of the companies, we will partner closely with ARM. The significant investments that has been made have positioned ARM to expand the reach of the ARM CPU beyond client computing to supercomputing, cloud, AI, and robotics. I expect ARM to be the most important CPU architecture of the next decade. ARM is an acronym for the Advanced Risk Machine company that licenses the architecture of the Reduced Instruction Set computer. Announced in September of 2020, the planned NVIDIA acquisition of ARM from SoftBank was, at the time, valued as a $40 billion deal, one of the most significant acquisitions ever in technology space. However, a company with the market clout of NVIDIA acquiring a wholesale instruction set architecture and chip designer quickly sparked pushbacks from some industry players, most notably ARM licensee juggernauts such as Qualcomm, Apple, and Samsung. Support for the acquisition among certain licensees seemed to be insufficient to reduce the fears of possible anti-competitive practices that might surge from the NVIDIA acquisition. But the deal faced close regulatory scrutiny from the get-go, as regulatory bodies time and again signaled their first impressions on the deal. The Federal Trade Commission, that's the FTC for one, sued to block it after calling it an illegal vertical merger. The UK government also signaled its worries at the acquisition attempt, despite NVIDIA also announcing a sizable investment to expand ARM's R&D presence in Cambridge, UK, with a new AI research and education center and an ARM NVIDIA-powered AI supercomputer. Even NVIDIA CEO must have seen the writing on the wall at some point. The world waits for no one, however, and ARM is quickly moving on towards the preparatory stages for its IPO, which has already been waived as an alternative to the NVIDIA purchase. ARM aims to complete the IPO within this fiscal year, which ends March the 31st. The failure isn't without its proverbial rolling head, however. The deal's failure brought a management shakeup at ARM, with the chief executive being replaced by someone else. Interestingly, the new replacement was the company's intellectual property unit head. As for NVIDIA, the company is losing the $1.25 billion deposit it agreed with SoftBank, irrespective if the deal went through or not. The company really was carrying all the weight, that's NVIDIA, and the risk on this transaction, which shows just how much NVIDIA wanted this deal to go through. But considering NVIDIA's stock performance in the meantime, and the fact that part of the acquisition was to be done through the company's shares, NVIDIA would end up paying around $66 billion, and NVIDIA either just losing $1.25 billion or saving $64.75 billion? Well, it's the way you look at it. In business as in life, it's all a matter of perspective. In a blockbuster announcement, Intel partners with RISC-V, which stands for the RISC Instruction Set Computer. It's a new company, and they are investing $1 billion, that's with a capital B, in Foundry Ecosystem Services. Up until now, Acorn Computers, also known as ARM, is the dominant reduced instruction architecture set for RISC machines. ARM doesn't make or build anything. They collect royalty fees from hardware manufacturers using the ARM instruction set architecture. The Intel-developed x86 x64 architecture has been the industry workhorse since the 1970s, while the ARM architecture was developed in the late 1980s for use on smaller systems. The major difference between the two architectures is that the x86 and x64 is a complex instruction set, also known as CISC, CISC, with many advanced features, while ARM is a reduced instruction set, that's RISC, R-I-S-C, that only has a handful of instructions by comparison. CISC allows for a computer to do more in a single instruction cycle, while RISC allows for simpler programming. An example is, if I were to say A plus B equals C, that's considered more than one step and is called complex instruction. But if I were to say load the accumulator with A, add B to the accumulator, store the accumulator in C, well, that's done in simple instruction steps, and that is what is meant by RISC. Generally speaking, RISC machines requires more clock cycles to complete the same instruction in CISC, but can do so more efficiently energy-wise, which makes them ideal for mobile applications, while x86/x64 remains the dominant architecture in the heavy processing market. ARM now faces serious competition from a new kid on the block, and that's RISC-V. Intel has joined RISC-V International Association, an open hardware standards organization dedicated to designing and building ultra-low-power processors. The news comes on the heels of another Intel announcement that it is investing $1 billion in foundry services. This follows ARM's failed merger with NVIDIA. Intel goes from not-invented-here attitude to a more open mindset. RISC-V is an open-standard instruction set architecture based on established reduced instruction set computer principles. Unlike most other instruction set architecture designs, the RISC-V is provided under open-source licenses that do not require fees to use. A number of companies are offering or have announced RISC-V architecture hardware. Open-source operating systems with RISC-V support are available, and the instruction set is supported in several popular software tool chains. Bob Brennan, the Vice President of Customer Solutions Engineering for Intel Foundry Services, will be joining both the RISC-V Board of Directors and Technical Steering Committee. Intel is also partnering with several RISC-V leaders, including Andes Technology, Esperanto Technologies, Sci-5, and Ventana Microsystems. The RISC-V ecosystem uses an open collaboration model similar to how Linux and other open-source software products are developed. This is unique in chip design. Developers have freedom to design their processors for specific domains and industries. RISC-V started as a project at UC Berkeley and has gained many supporters, but Intel is by far the biggest supporter to back the project. We look forward to optimizing intellectual property for Intel process technologies to ensure that RISC-V runs best on silicon across all types of cores, from embedded to high performance, said Brennan in a statement. Intel already offers processors based on RISC-V design and has a deal with another RISC-V developer, Sci-5, to create a new development platform called Horse Creek, which will feature Sci-5's new performance P550 cores. Intel has also signed up Sci-5 for its foundry services, so Intel's interest and investment in RISC-V is only going to accelerate the development of RISC-V intellectual property. To help support this development, Intel is establishing a $1 billion fund to support the foundry ecosystem and help chip companies to develop both chip and packaging technologies. Intel says the fund will support multiple instruction set architecture, also spanning the x86, ARM, and RISC-V. The Intel Foundry Services is also working on something called the Open Chiplet Platform. One of the goals of the fund is to advance the concept of 3D chiplet design, where multiple different architectures are tightly integrated onto one die. In theory, that could mean chips with x86, ARM, and RISC-V cores are all on one piece of silicon. Well, RISC-V's gain is ARM's loss. While there's no question that RISC-V comes out ahead in this deal, it's another sign that ARM is losing serious ground. The protracted attempted acquisition by NVIDIA, now canceled, has to have set ARM back significantly. It could not strike deals while the acquisition was pending, and its planned IPO could hamper things further. That's not to say that ARM's processors are suddenly going to be swapped out of smartphones. ARM still enjoys significant support in the marketplace and among OEMs, and that isn't going to go away anytime soon. But its momentum was seriously kneecapped over the past year, and RISC-V is taking full advantage of it. Expect a flurry of ARM deals in the coming months as it tries to regain momentum. How important is this announcement? This is significant, as it gives Intel the flexibility it needs to offer a diverse set of solutions to potential customers. It's not enough to just license a RISC-V CPU core. That core needs to hook to memory controllers, expansion buses, and possibly other compute devices depending on the role the RISC-V core plays in the system. This is some announcement. IBM emails show millennial workers favored over dino babies. That's a new definition for someone who is over the age of 45. The communications show highly incriminating animus against older employees by officials who at the time were in the company's highest ranks, according to the filing on Friday. The partially redacted filing says the emails surface in separate arbitration proceedings, but it doesn't reveal the identities of the company's officials or indicate when they were speaking. A judge has ordered the release of versions of the underlying documents. In one email chain, an International Business Machine Corporation official, that's IBM, described a plan to accelerate change by inviting the dino babies, that's a new species, by the way, that I'm not aware of, and turn them into extinct species, according to the filing. Company officials also complain about IBM's dated maternal workforce that must change and discuss frustration that IBM had a much lower share of millennials in its workforce than a competitor, but said its share would increase following layoffs, according to the filing. An IBM spokesperson said in a statement that the company never engaged in systematic age discrimination and it terminated employees because of changing business conditions, not because of their age. In 2020, the median age of IBM's U.S. workforce was 48, the same as it was in 2010, according to the statement. The spokesperson also said the language cited in the emails is not consistent with the respect IBM has for its employees, and as the facts clearly show, it does not reflect company practices or policies. The company faces age bias complaints in arbitration and court proceedings by former employees across the country. A former IBM vice president of human resources said in a court deposition in one of the cases that the company faced talent recruitment problems and determined one way to show millennials that IBM was not an old fuddy-duddy organization was to make itself appear as a cool, trendy organization. Well, you change the business model if you want to do that. It's not, well, let me use the proper term, terminating older employees. Friday's filing was submitted by a lawyer who represents hundreds of workers suing the company. The lawyer said that IBM has engaged in egregious age discrimination, and IBM has tried to use arbitration clauses to shield that evidence from the public and other employees who are trying to build their cases of discrimination. Chinese lithography firm rebukes ASML over patent infringement claims. The term intellectual property is referred to as a work or invention that is a result of creativity, such as a manuscript or design, to which one has rights and for which one may apply for a patent, copyright, trademark, etc. But not all countries share the same definition of what is intellectual property. ASML Holding, originally standing for Advanced Semiconductor Materials Lithography, commonly shortened to ASML, is a Dutch multinational corporation founded in 1984 and specializes in the development and manufacturing of photolithography systems. ASML currently is the largest supplier of photolithography systems, primarily for the semiconductor industry, and the sole supplier of extreme ultraviolet lithography, that's EUV, photolithography machines in the world. Chinese lithography firm Dongfang Jinhuan claims its success relies on independent R&D and innovation and rebukes ASML over patent infringement claims. Last week, it became public knowledge that Pivotal chipmaking equipment maker ASML had pointed the finger of suspicion at a Chinese rival, raising the possibility of intellectual property infringements. Dongfang Jinhuan Microelectronics Technology, the company, released a strongly worded statement denying any underhand activities and pledging that its work was solely based on independent R&D. Dongfang Jinhuan hinted that it was even considering legal action due to the dissemination of false information. ASML highlighted associations between Dongfang Jinhuan and Xtor. The latter, Xtor, lost a legal battle with ASML in 2019 when a U.S. court found that it had stolen the Dutch tech firm's trade secrets. As a result, ASML was awarded punitive damages of $845 million, and the damages were so high because the judge found Xtor acted purposely and maliciously. Additionally, the court issued an injunction to stop working on any software products that ASML alleged were contaminated with its intellectual property. With its research in hand, ASML said it approached the Chinese companies under suspicion, which were unresponsive to communications. To push the matter, ASML then contacted Chinese officials with its concerns. However, ASML's action seemingly went beyond initiating investigations and raising concerns to government trade bodies. Perhaps the firm was a bit hasty here, but the previous report stated that ASML asked its customers to avoid business transactions with Dongfang Jinhuan. These requests could carry considerable weight due to ASML's status as an essential pillar in the semiconductor industry. Dongfang Jinhuan's public statement regarding ASML's accusations and actions is understandably and predictably, well, gruff and is packed with denials. In essence, the Chinese firm says it's been operating in compliance. Let me repeat. They said that they've been operating in compliance with Chinese laws and regulations since its founding. Moreover, the statement asserts that Dongfang Jinhuan adheres to the concept of independent research and development and independent innovation, and of course, they respect and protect intellectual property rights. Dongfang Jinhuan appears to be more than upset by accusation of patent infringement behavior. Illustrating this, it mentions that it may turn to legal action to fight back against false information. Dongfang Jinhuan had some degree of special status in China as a tech startup that has been given governmental praise and approval with reduced scrutiny from regulators. Such firms are called little giants in China's tech business circles. It would be interesting to see such a case brought in the United States or Europe. But if this little giant is as cosseted in China as reports suggest, this statement could be viewed simply as a piece of, well, theater. Ultimately, if Dongfang Jinhuan is as it claims important to China's core semiconductor technology development hopes, Chinese regulators might not be concerned about any Western criticism. Why, after all, Dongfang Jinhuan said they operated under Chinese regulation and law, so how could they do anything wrong? Every employee who leaves Apple becomes an associate. In job databases used by employers to verify resume information, every former employee titles get erased and replaced with a generic title of associate. For most organizations, your job classification differentiates the compensation between levels. Often, the job title helps determine how much you can earn when you leave the company for another job. But at Apple, there's a hitch. In widely used databases that companies refer to for verification of job information, Apple changes the job title for every employee, whether they're a PhD in computer science or a product manager, to associate. Apple's approach is largely unnoticed by anybody, but a handful of job applicants whose resumes conflict with official databases maintained by job verification services run by companies such as Equifax and LexisNexis. The title associate is generally used to connotate more junior roles. Entry-level retail workers, for instance, are often called associates. Law firms refer to recent law school hires in the same way, and in universities, associate professors are ranked below those with the title professor. The practice recently came to light when Cher Scarlett, a former Apple software engineer who raised concerns about alleged discrimination and misconduct at the company, filed a complaint to the Securities and Exchange Commission alleging that when Apple changed her job title to associate, it delayed the hiring process at a prospective employer by nearly a week, during which time the company rescinded the offer. Scarlett said the job verification service hired to vet her resume was unable to resolve the discrepancy with Apple. Now she's leading a worker uprising at Apple. Apple spokesman Josh Rosenstock confirmed that for years, Apple has changed the job titles of its former employees to associate. Rosenstock declined to say why Apple does this or precisely when the practice began. He said, "We are and have always been deeply committed to creating and maintaining a positive and inclusive workplace. We take all concerns seriously and we thoroughly investigate whenever a concern is raised, and out of respect for the privacy of any individuals involved, we do not discuss specific employee matters." Scarlett, a software engineer on Apple's security team, last year helped found the Pound Apple II movement, which encourages employees at the company to speak out about workplace misconduct, and in mostly anonymous testimonials, hundreds of employees have shared stories of what the group calls persistent patterns of racism, sexism, inequity, discrimination, intimidation, suppression, coercion, abuse, unfair punishment, and unchecked privilege. She left the company last year after she said she was intimidated and retaliated against. On September the 1st last year, Scarlett filed a charge with the National Labor Relations Board alleging Apple's practices violate federal labor law. The case is being investigated. In October, Scarlett filed a whistleblower complaint with the SEC, accusing Apple of misleading investors when it issued a statement to shareholders asserting that it does not use concealment clauses in separation agreements or settlements with employees. Scarlett says Apple asked her to sign such a clause when she left the company. Apple has declined to comment on her specific allegation or specific employee matters. Apple offers a phone number that employers can call to verify titles of former Apple employees. A voice recording on that line directs callers to the website for InVerified, an employment verification service provider owned by credit agency Equifax. When the Washington Post called InVerify's customer support number, a customer service representative said Apple is the only company he knew of that changes job titles of employees when they leave. Apple also changes title for employees who have taken a leave of absence. The representative said he gets a few calls a month from people trying to get the accurate job title of former Apple employees. If the caller can provide the employee's full Social Security number, InVerify is able to look up the person's old payroll information and verify the job title that way. But even people who've verified job titles for a living can be stumped by the unorthodox system for verifying accurate job titles for former Apple employees. I got a question. I guess if you were to ask Apple if Steve Jobs was ever an Apple CEO, you would get back the answer he was an associate. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series. You need to become a tech leader.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about how you can fit in into the modern technology world, how you can do better, and so forth and so on. This week, I want to encourage you in the idea of working to become not a technology user, but actually a technology leader. I wish for you to move up. I wish for you to move further. I wish for you to move higher in the office environment. It used to be that we would just leave whatever it was that was nerdy over to the folks in IT. If we needed anything done with our computers beyond, yes, our typing letters or entering in formulas into Excel, we would reach out to information technology. I recall 20 years ago, I was part of a support team for a large oil and gas corporation. And one of the things that I had on a regular basis was a few different people would reach out to me on a regular basis for Excel formulas and sorting those out. But today, you need to leverage what you have, both the knowledge, but the access to the various bits and pieces of data. You need to empower yourself with who you are and what you can provide to do your job better. To replace information technology, to replace whoever it is that's supporting you and move into a self-support role. What do I mean by this? You have a certain flow of information that's going past you. This flow of information can be in the form of many different things, and it's not the flow that's important here. The flow is important to some extent because you're the person who has that particular individualized flow, but you have that particular individualized information, and you need to be able to crunch that data, to process that, and to get new, interesting, exciting information that will move the company forward. You do this through reports. You do this through whatever it is that you're working on. And you need to take this to a next level. You need to find out if widget number one isn't really cost effective for the company to make. We only make 7 of these in a year, and they cost us twice as much as what we sell them for. Why are we carrying widget one? We've got widget 7 over here. Widget 7 is highly profitable. We could also increase the price on widget 7 because there's so high of a demand on it. So you see how I'm thinking there? You see how I'm going at this? And all of this is just a matter of you taking the information that's passing by you and you spending just a few minutes each day trying to understand a little bit more in regards to this. The people in charge of your company are going to start tracking who is savvy. and they will help you move forward if you are asking the right questions. Whatever the statistics are, whatever the metrics are, whatever the information flow is that you are asking questions on, that you are moving forward, this will help your company move forward. And if your company moves forward because you're moving forward, you will move up. You can empower yourself on the various smaller projects. People everywhere can now start to optimize their work and fix tech problems on their own. My son, he works a variety of data projects and he never involves IT. Now, okay, so he is IT knowledgeable without being part of IT. He is in a role where he is hired and works as kind of an adjunct IT person. He's creating data dashboards. He's building small applications. He's automating items faster than he can ask someone else to do this. I do this as well. And I'm in IT. I recently combined the output of three different databases to develop a tool that nobody in our very large company had built or even considered. I spent maybe 40 hours of time doing this. It would take somebody a matter of 2 or 3 hours to crunch all of this data down. I managed to do this so that anybody could come along and do this in under 5 minutes. See, all of this is a matter of fixing data problems without IT. Now, you know what IT is also doing? They're tracking who is a burden. They're tracking who isn't doing a whole lot, who isn't providing value to the bottom line of the company. And yes, they're doing this at management directive. And management directive is going to be along the way to remove the obstacles. So they're going to promote the people who are good and remove the people who are not good. Look, I want you to be a part of the future. I want you to join in and leverage technology to make you more successful. Whether it's more information, faster information, or being just a little bit less of a burden on your employer. Again, part of the future, not the past. I want you, just over the course of the coming months, reflect on how you can convert over into being not a technology user, but yes, a technology leader. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Have we reached the limits of semiconductor technology? An atom is one of the basic units of matter. Everything around us is made up of atoms. An atom is a million times smaller than the thickest human hair. The diameter of an atom ranges from about 0.1 to 0.5 nanometers. An atom is the smallest unit of the ordinary matter that forms a chemical element. Every solid, liquid, gas, and plasma is composed of neutral or ionized atoms. Atoms are extremely small, typically around 100 picometers across. They are so small that accurately predicting their behavior using classical physics is quite difficult. Last May 2021, IBM unveiled a breakthrough in semiconductor design and process with the development of the world's first chip announced with 2 nanometers nanosheet technology. A transistor is a physical object. However, and being purely physical, it is governed by laws of physics like every other physical object. That means there is a physical limit to how small a transistor can be. Back when Gordon Moore made his famous prediction about the pace of growth in computing power, no one was really thinking about transistors at nanometer scales. For those who are too young to know, what is Moore's law? The principle that the speed and capability of computers can be expected to double every 2 years as a result of increases in the number of transistors a microchip can contain. This was an observation that Gordon Moore made, 40, 50 years ago. But as we enter the third decade of the 21st century, our reliance on packing more transistors into the same amount of silicon is brushing up against the very boundaries of what is physically possible, leading many to worry that the pace of innovation we've become accustomed to might come to a screeching end in the very near future. A silicon atom is 0.2 nanometers wide. At these scales, controlling the flow of electrons becomes increasingly more difficult as all kinds of quantum effects play themselves out with the transistor itself. With larger transistors, a deformation of the crystal on a scale of atoms doesn't affect the overall flow of current. But when you have only about 10 atoms distance to work with, any changes in the underlying atomic structure are going to affect this current through the transistors. Ultimately, the transistor is approaching the point where it is simply as small as we can ever make it and have it still function. The way we've been building and improving silicon chips is coming to its final iteration. There is also another potential pitfall for Moore's law, and that is simple economics. The cost of shrinking transistors isn't decreasing the way it was in the 1960s. At best, it's decreasing slightly generation over generation. But economies of scales are starting to weigh fabrication down. When the demand for semiconductor chips was first taking off, the engineering capacity to produce the chips was expensive, but it was at least available. With demand for everything from smartphones to satellites to the Internet of Things skyrocketing, there just isn't enough capacity to meet that demand, which increases prices at every step of the supply chain. What's more, when the number of transistors doubles, so does the amount of heat they can generate. The cost of cooling large server rooms is getting more and more untenable for many businesses that are the biggest purchasers of the most advanced processing chips. As businesses try to extend the life and performance of their current equipment to save money, chip makers responsible for fulfilling Moore's law bring in less revenue to devote to R&D, which itself is becoming more expensive. Without that extra revenue, it becomes much harder to overcome all the physical impediments to shrinking the transistors even further. So even if the physical challenges don't bring an end to Moore's law, the lack of demand for smaller transistors almost certainly will. Okay, so what are we going to do about it? Well, it's no longer the $64 question. It's the $1 trillion question at this point. We've spent the last 70 years experiencing an unprecedented technological advance so that rapid technological progress is taken as a given by just about every industrial society at this point. How do you suddenly bring that to a halt? What would that even feel like? What would it mean to have the same iPhone for 30 years? Obviously, we would simply deal with that as a society. There's nothing in our DNA that mandates that we have to have a new iPhone every 2 to 3 years and an entirely new computer every 5. We've simply become accustomed to that pace of progress, and if that pace changes, we would acclimate ourselves to that as well. After all, humanity has only had computers for less than a century, or about, 1/250,000th of the time we've been on this planet as a species. We will certainly find a way to endure such a calamitous hardship. Alternatively, we can look to the end of Moore's law with excitement and anticipation. Adversity, of course, is the mother of invention. After all, we spent the past 70 years trying to figure out how to shrink the transistor more and more, and now that path of innovation is reaching its end. It is absolutely not the only way forward, and if we no longer are putting all our efforts into shrinking transistors, we can put that energy into other areas and discover new breakthroughs that might make invention of the transistor look banal in comparison. We won't know until we explore these new avenues of innovation, and the end of Moore's law might be the signal we need that it's time to start looking for a new engine of progress. In the end, Moore's law was never a law to begin with, but more of a self-fulfilling aspiration. We expected transistor density to double every year, then every 2 years, and so we've looked for how we could accomplish that task. Whatever the next thing is, whether it's quantum computing, machine learning and artificial intelligence, or even something we don't even have a name for yet, we'll find a new aspiration to drive the innovation forward. Ultimately, our fascination with Moore's law was never really about the density of the transistors. Most people who've heard of Moore's law couldn't even begin to explain what transistor densities even mean, much less how interlocking transistors form logical circuits, or how the smartphone in their pocket works, or even a 1970 pocket calculator for that matter. For most of us, Moore's Law was always about our expectation of progress, and that is something that's largely up to us. Moore's Law, however, might be on its last legs. What is ISP throttling, and what can you do about it? While some people use the term throttling and shaping interchangeably, they are distinct concepts. Throttling refers to a connection-wide speed reduction. So no matter what you're doing, it will happen more slowly on your internet connection than usual. Internet service providers can throttle your internet connection to a slower speed than advertised. They also use a practice known as shaping, where throttling is applied selectively to traffic. So how do you know if you're being throttled or shaped? Shaping, on the other hand, is the practice of limiting connection speeds on a per-protocol basis. Different types of network traffic have different communication protocols. So it's easy for your ISP to see whether your internet packets are from web browsing, video streaming, torrenting, and so on. A shaped connection might clamp down or even block certain types of traffic while letting other services run at the highest speed possible. Why do ISP throttle or shape connections? Network bandwidth is a finite resource. So one of the main jobs an ISP has is making sure that everyone on the network has a good experience. When networks are quiet at the early AM hours, the few users who need lots of bandwidth can get it. However, at peak times, such as when everyone is streaming video after dinner, can put the network under pressure. This is when they may decide to throttle or shape connections to prioritize certain kinds of traffic, or to fairly share the available bandwidth among all users until things quiet down. Some ISP packages may also implement a soft cap written into the fine print of your contract. For example, there may be a rolling monthly bandwidth amount where you'll be throttled after exceeding it. This is to prevent heavy bandwidth users, often on cheaper packages, from abusing their connections. ISPs are buying bandwidth from providers on tiers above them. So although there may be no hard cap on your connection, throttling may be necessary to protect their profits. Connection shaping happens for various reasons, and some of them are genuinely about quality of service during peak network congestion. But it can also be a way to advertise faster speeds than a user gets in reality. Essentially, low bandwidth services such as email or web browsing may run at the advertised speed, but as soon as you try to download software or watch a video, that speed goes down. It can be hard to prove that you're being shaped. Internet speed tests are obviously something ISPs won't shape, so that number tells us nothing. There are a number of tools that try to detect traffic shaping, such as ShaperProbe and Bonafide. What can you do about shaping? In most cases, you don't actually have to do anything special to detect if you're being shaped or not. That's because you can use a VPN to circumvent most types of shaping. That is, unless VPN traffic itself is being shaped. But that's unlikely to be the case. In other words, if your internet performance improves after switching a VPN on, chances are some shaping was going on. The VPN solution is generally a good one, but you can also eliminate shaping by changing your internet plan to one that explicitly says it's unshaped. These internet plans tend to be more expensive, but it also means that you get the advertised speed no matter what type of application you're using. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston, Bosch Freak Wrench and Driver.
Marty Winston joins me now. What is your thought on toll-free numbers, other than the fact that it sounds cool, 888-NERD-888?
Well, it does. But, you know, when I grew up, the phone company was always Bell. And the only question shareholders ever had is, for whom Bell tolls?
And the answer was everybody.
Yeah, yes. Especially Western Electric.
Yeah. So I see you've got a tool in your hand from, it's blue, so it's going to be Bosch.
That is correct.
And what's it called?
It's the Bosch Freak.
Freak. What? Freak?
F-R-E-A-K.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I can tell you,
yes,
it's freaking awesome.
Oh, my. We're hitting right at the edge there. Okay. But yes.
All right. Take a look at the maw. And what do you see on that? For people on the radio, take a very close look and you can see the business end of this 18-volt brushless power tool.
Okay, so it's squared off. It's got a round. So I'm presuming there's some kind of a bit that goes into it versus a screw down.
It can take hex bits, but the square bit also means it can be used as a wrench with standard sockets.
Okay, all right.
One tool that does both.
Nice.
So now you
so
know.
It really is a freak. It is. Yeah, it's quite different. All right.
Now, Bosch has something of, I don't know, maybe I follow power tools a little more than some people.
Yeah. Well, yes, I'll agree with that one. Yeah.
Bosch has managed to just really reinvent itself considerably, and this certainly helps manifest that. If you take a look at the side, there's a lock. Mm-hmm. There's a lock on the handle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what's the lock for? Is that to lock down the battery?
Uh-huh.
Looks like. Okay.
And the battery is smart, and there are controls down on the base for things like the mode and the speed. You've got two modes and three speeds from essentially elastomeric buttons down here.
Okay, so, yeah.
Not radio people, take a, you have to focus.
Got to watch. Got it. Yes.
Yeah. I wasn't even sure this was ever coming, and it mm-hmm. showed up, and I thought I was supposed to get a driver and a wrench.
Mm-hmm.
It's a driver and a wrench in one. Isn't it great only having to carry one tool with you
to get the
job done? You know, you're carrying three cases of bits and things, but it's really kind of cool. Now, Bosch also has done some amazing things with hammer drill drivers, and we talked about that last month.
Mm-hmm.
Their hammer drill driver building again into a compact instrument with really good arm feel. You don't make your elbow feel like a giant woodpecker has been picking on you after you use it for
a while. Yeah.
So I don't know, more of my tool sets turning blue lately.
Yes. You know, and that's something that, so I like Bosch. I have been eyeing some Bosch items in the past recently because I am actually starting to move into some of that woodworking stuff. They're definitely a solid name within the industry. And
look, they come from the automotive industry.
Yes.
And if you're turning DC motors, if you're making control happen, boy, are you in their sweet spot. You're in their wheelhouse with this stuff.
And actually, it's really weird because they go into a number of different directions. I had no idea. So when I bought my house about a year ago, I'm wandering through and there's the washer and dryer. And both of those were Bosch. It's like I had no idea they made washers and dryers. So
it was a bit of a surprise to me, and I should have remembered this. My Frigidaire is made by Electrolux,
mm-hmm.
and it can't clean a carpet to save its life.
So this wrench driver unit, the Freak.
This Freak.
Freak. It sounds like it comes fully outfitted with all of the different wrench items and bits and all of that.
No, not so much. It's an empty box. Doesn't even include a battery in this version.
Uh-oh.
But it has, and I'll show it to you people on radio. You might need a flashlight for this. It has a couple of hex bits in it.
Okay, all right.
And it does have an organizer for your socket toolbox.
Okay.
It doesn't have the sockets, but it has the organizer.
Okay.
It might have the sockets. I haven't opened it up yet. But it's really, You can see this in my hand. The entire motor isn't much bigger than my hand.
Yeah, yeah. It's it's a little bit smaller than a fist.
Yeah, it's so muscular. I think it's one of the guardians of the galaxy of power tools. Maybe Rocket.
Yeah, there you go. Yes. Oh, man.
Boy. And I have to tell you, CES, which we talked about for the last couple of weeks, really did not have a strong showing of power tools.
Yeah? Interesting.
And there were times when they did, because you had installers, you know, putting in sound systems and networking and high-end audio and all that. So happy to get this in the mail.
Very cool. This is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston. You're listening to Computer Talk Radio.
Thank you, Ben, and thank you, Marty. The upcoming 46th Annual Original Personal Computer Festival, otherwise known as TCF, the original and oldest computer festival in the world, is March the 19th, 2022. It is a virtual festival via Zoom, and the website is tcf-nj.org. The time for the festival is from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, and the keynote speaker is Bob Kopp, Disrupting Environmental Climate Changing Using Technology, and he is the co-author of the UN World Climate Change Report. He is from the Rutgers Institute for Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences. At the festival, there will be other interesting topics of presentation, such as secure communications with quantum computing, computers changing photography, Bitcoin trading using neural networks, ham, cram, and testing, and a full day of presentations on IT professional topics. Saturday, March the 19th, 2022, the time is from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time, and the website is tcf-nj.org. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. By the way, if you're interested in attending any of the club meetings that have remote access, log on to their club website for remote meeting ID. The Brookdale Computer Users Group has a presentation on topics on privacy. Thursday, February the 24th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. Virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is pcug.com. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on disruptions at scale through innovation. Thursday, March the 3rd. Meeting time 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, March the 4th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is also available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.